before, just now before coming over here, I was gazing out over the lake and watching the sunset. And for some reason, when I see the sun going down or coming up, I guess maybe because the shape of it is easier to see than usually, and I get reminded that that's a star, that thing, like the stars we see at night. There's something amazing to me about the fact that that's a star. We don't think, we kind of take the sun for granted a lot. It's just that thing, bright thing, lights up the sky. But that's a star. I think that's incredible. I think it takes the light from the sun to about around 8 minutes to get here. So we never, it's always looking into the past. And then those stars up overhead, the closest one, it's still about 4.5 years for that light to get us to us. That's the closest one. I mean, we can't even grasp that, but then these astronomers, they're looking at galaxies that are, the light that we see is 13 billion years old. We're seeing what it was like 13 billion years ago. I think they're just making that stuff up. But you know, the sun, it could go out and it would be about 8 minutes before we'd know it. I hope it didn't go out just now. It would make my Dharma talk kind of interesting. It would change the flavor of things. Sometimes our path in this practice somehow that we might hold it as, however we think of it, but often it's described of as a kind of journey or a movement towards some understanding or realization, and it's talked about in lots of different ways. As movement towards deeper and deeper stages of insight, or realizing our Buddha nature, realizing the natural perfection of the mind and heart, or all these different things pointing towards some culmination of the understanding that's possible for us. And one way that it's spoken about, and maybe this is especially common in some of the countries in Asia that have been steeped in the Buddhist tradition for a long time, is in terms of what are called the paramis. Same word is paramita in Sanskrit. And these are 10 qualities in the Theravada tradition, this tradition that we come from. It's said that there are 10 qualities, and it's said that in this sort of the mythical story that the Buddha perfected these, or the Buddha-to-be, the Bodhisattva, perfected these over countless lifetimes. This sort of mythical story. And there are these stories, they're called Jataka tales, and they're stories of some of these different lifetimes, and often the Buddha, not yet the Buddha, is born as an animal, different animals, a deer or a tiger or a something like that. And they're kind of teaching stories in a way. And it said that he perfected these 10 qualities. And so I'll read them to you. I'll give you the Pali name and then the English translation. So the first of them is dana, which is generosity or giving. Sila, or moral conduct, ethical conduct, you could say. Nekama, which is renunciation, relinquishment, letting go. Panya is translated as wisdom or insight. Virya is energy or effort, or courageous kind of effort. Kanti is patience. Satcha is truthfulness or honesty. Adhidhana is determination or resolve. Metta, we've been talking about, friendliness, kindness. And upekkha, or equanimity, that Marie spoke about quite a bit last night as one of the factors of awakening. Some of these things show up on different ones of these lists. And so in this way of looking at our practice, we could say that its culmination, the end of it, the fulfillment of it, the ripening of it, is when these qualities are fully developed. They are brought to a state of a kind of perfection, you could say. And so another way of looking at it is that when the energies of the kilesas, of greed, hatred, and delusion, all the ways those energies show up, when those are no longer running our lives, no longer holding sway over the mind and heart, then these paramis there are a natural response to life. When we're freed from our habitual patterns of reactivity and the things that keep us struggling and suffering a lot of the time. And I think that to reflect on our practice in terms of these qualities and their nurturing and development is always useful and also very very skillful and powerful way to look at things, because it really expands the breadth of what we think of as our practice. You know, we come on retreat and we get very focused on the meditation, maybe on developing some concentration and certain things like that, and we may overlook that some of these other qualities are really being nurtured no matter what's going on. You know, maybe this whole retreat is about developing a kind of determination, resolve to keep at it, or developing some other quality here, some kind of renunciation where we're letting go of all of the things that we're used to clinging to, developing patience. And I think it also can really help us kind of let go of, or it helps to cut through our strong habit that we find so often in the mind and heart to be assessing our practice and comparing it with either ideas we have about how it's supposed to be, or with things we've read, or we hear someone else speaking in some way, and we assess our own practice, and we look at our experience, we're looking for some evidence, we judge our experience, we judge what's happening, then we judge ourselves because of our perception that it's not any good. But if we think in terms of these paramis, then it can help to diminish that tendency, to lessen it. Because if the whole retreat is just about this willingness to stay at it, begin again as many times as we have to do that each time we start, we sit down, and we have to come back again. Mind wanders, we come back. And just through that, we're really developing some beautiful, powerful qualities of these paramis. You know, we come to this retreat, or a retreat like this, and, you know, we're just hoping to find some ease or calm or peace, and we sit down and start meditating, and that's not necessarily what we get, you know. We find this restless, uncomfortable body that won't do what we want and won't behave, and it hurts. And this wild, uncontrollable mind that's all over the place. You know, it's not, we didn't give you a particularly uncomfortable body and a wild mind as when you came in the door last Saturday. You weren't issued that. But sometimes it feels like we got that, you know. But it's the same mind and body we had before. We're just spending a lot of time with it. And so, you know, we sit down and all this stuff shows up, all this resistance and pettiness, all these, everything that we've done our best to forget or have put somewhere so we don't have to look at it, it shows up. You know, and some of it's really difficult. And then, not only that, but all the stuff that maybe isn't hard to be with, but it's just boring or repetitious. You know, embarrassing. Everything we've ever, every stupid TV show we've ever watched, it's in there. Every stupid song from some commercial. I mean, is there anyone in here who would willingly volunteer if I had some kind of apparatus that I could hook up to you so that the contents of your mind could be played over a speaker? Would any of you volunteer for us to get to listen to that soundtrack? This would be a tragic experience. If I did it, you would leave immediately. You'd have nothing more to do with me. At least some of the time. Once in a while it might be okay. But sooner or later, everything that's in there is going to come up. And some of it's really hard to be with. You know, it's just, some of it's so unacceptable, so hard to see some of what's in our minds and hearts sometimes. And if we've tried to keep it aside or you know, put it somewhere so we don't have to see it, sooner or later it's going to show up. And we're setting ourselves up for some problems. We're going to have to look at everything sooner or later. There's a story about a famous Tibetan teacher who came to... I think he moved to the United States, was living there. His name was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, very famous founder of the Shambhala but the Shambhala folks are followers of his. And he was quite famous as a teacher, and there were events that were held at different times, and this was a story for an event that was held somewhere in near San Francisco, Berkeley, California, somewhere there. And at a big hall, and they had sold tickets. It was an event you had to pay probably a pretty good amount of money to go to. And he had a tendency to show up really late to pretty much anything he was supposed to do. And so people were waiting and waiting, and finally he showed up. And he said, if you want your money back, it's all right. Just go to the door and ask for it back. It's quite fine. In fact, if you haven't started the spiritual path, it's best not to begin. It's difficult, it's terrible, and you have to face all kinds of things you won't like. As far as the ego is concerned, it is just one insult after another. This is kind of like what Marie said the other night, that self-knowledge, it was the author John Barth said, self-knowledge is pretty much always bad news. If we look at it this way. And sometimes it feels like that. You know, we sit down and it just feels like one insult after another to have to be with the contents of our mind. But, you know, the power and beauty of this practice is that we develop a relationship with our entire being, not just part of it, not just the parts that we would broadcast over the speaker, but the whole thing. And if we don't develop a relationship with our entire being, we'll never bring this practice to fullness, to completion. It's not possible to leave anything out. And so we need to bring these qualities, these parami qualities. They have to be there to support us, because this practice demands a kind of, I would call it a kind of radical honesty. And a radical kind of intimacy with our whole being, every part of it. And so if we're going to stay balanced and have some steadiness with that, we need these qualities We need kindness. We need patience. We need resolve. We need these things to keep us going. Because there's times when it's going to be really hard. And there'll be times when we get caught in some old habit of mind, some pattern that we have seen. You know, we're kind of retraining our mind and heart in a certain way. You could say we're unlearning a lifetime of habits that aren't really useful. And some of them are like deep grooves that will tend to go down so easily. And the only way that we're going to go to any depth is to stick with it. And that's the key, to be determined in a certain way, to have a certain kind of resolve. Because if we're fighting or struggling with our mind and heart, we're just going to suffer. We'll create a situation where we're never okay, where we can never find ease. And so times when it is difficult, if we hold them in the right way, we can see them as a certain kind of opportunity, because they help us build a certain strength and determination, willingness to keep at it. You know, if we're struggling against ourselves, you could say, we're just going to run out of energy and we're not going to be able to keep going. But if we can cultivate an attitude of some kind of care, maybe even a certain kind of respect for what's difficult, for our struggles, for our difficult mind states when they come, we can learn to see them as helping us to develop some of these qualities of resolve and determination and patience, kindness. I heard a story about a very well-known teacher who's a Buddhist monk. He was born in England, but he's ordained in Thailand. He's from the Thai forest tradition, and he lives and teaches in England, but he teaches all over the world. A very highly regarded teacher, and he told a story once. He was doing his own retreat practice, and he was at one of the monasteries where he lived, and there was a temple, a shrine temple that you would find in those kinds of places, and it had a path that went around it, and there were there was a Buddha statue on one side, and he was doing walking meditation around this. And in his story, every time he came around to where the Buddha statue was, he would bow to it and he would offer his mind state. He would place his mind state on the altar and bow to that. Whatever it was. Bow to his frustration. Bow to his anger. Bow to his joy. Honoring the truth of things, you could say. Honoring this part of himself. Seeing that this is a vehicle. It's all a vehicle for understanding. I thought that was a beautiful image, that we could bow to these parts of ourselves that we often reject and judge as wrong or bad. If we think of the quality of patience, one of these kanti in Pali, one of these paramis, and you know, we get a lot of chances to work on that over the course of a day and in our lives outside of retreat times. You know, usually we learn about patience by exploring impatience, exploring when it isn't there. Do you know this word, patience? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the Finnish word? Is there one word?
Kärsivällisyys.
What she said. When I think about this, sometimes when I talk about this subject of patience, and this idea that we learn a lot about patience by exploring when it's not there. And I remember when my parents were, before they died in the last couple of years of their life, my parents both lived to be almost 92 years old, and they had been married and living together for 70 years. Now there's an example of some patience, I think, somewhere in there. But it was hard in the last years. My mother had very decline in her mental abilities, a kind of diminishment of a kind of dementia. And it was very, very hard, and very, very hard on my father, because he felt like he was losing this person that he loved. And my sister and I were very involved in trying to help them and look after them with some really hard decisions that had to be made. And it was, you know, so this is some years ago, but I was teaching already, starting to teach, and, you know, it's easy, fairly easy to be kind of kind and wise in meditation centers and monasteries and that kind of place, but go hang out with your parents, and that's a real reality check. That's where the rubber meets the road, as we say in the States. You know, because they may not mean to, but they know how to... Do you know the expression, to push your buttons? They don't do it on purpose, maybe, but they sure are good at it. And so, you know, I'd be visiting them, trying to be a good son and help, and I'd suddenly find I was acting like an angry teenager or a little boy, you know, and it's humbling. You know, I'm gray-haired, I'm an old guy, I'm supposed to be wise. And so, you know, there was so much, and with my poor mother, you know, her short-term memory, the memory of recent things, gone. So we would have the same conversations over and over. I know some of you have probably had this experience. And I sometimes just couldn't take it. And I would say things, or to my father, when he would behave in ways that I weren't kind to my mom, and I would say things, and it would be, I would feel so terrible to say these things. And I'd have to, you know, I would apologize and try to make amends for this behavior. So, you know, we get these opportunities to work on patients that are sometimes really hard in life. So being willing to actually explore impatience, the lack of patience, when patience is really not there at all, is that's how we learn a lot about it, and to be willing to go through all of the difficult aspects, you know, and see, how does that feel? What is it? How is it in the body? How is it in the mind? What happens when we identify with it and take it on as being something about me? Or, as I was saying before, these deep, old mental patterns that we sometimes see in meditation that keep showing up. And these give us real opportunities to develop patience. And, you know, we feel like we've seen these things from every side and we understand them. And they still keep showing up, and it feels like, should have let go of this by now. And they just show up again. And it's like one of my colleagues calls them karmic knots. You know, it's like we're fish, and there's a hook with bait on it, and we know it's a hook, and we know it's bait, and we're watching ourselves go up, and I'm gonna bite it. I know I'm gonna bite it. And then we do, and we get caught. And wriggle around and then spit it out eventually. I was doing my own retreat a few years ago, and I got really caught in this old, very negative and self-defeating mind state. Really, really difficult. Couldn't sleep. It kept me up all night. Really intense. And at some point, I thought to myself, and I told myself, I said these words in my mind. I said, you know, Greg, this is not the last time you're going to feel like this. And there was something very kind in saying that to myself. It was like acknowledging the fact. It wasn't like a defeated place. It was actually a kindness of saying, you know, this one is going to be around, and you better find a way to hold it differently and stop struggling with this, because you're going to feel this way again. It's guaranteed. That was very helpful for me. It released something in that moment to tell myself, you know, this isn't the last time this is going to come up. And so patience gives us some some energy and strength, this quality of patience, to be able to actually see these things that we feel so tired of seeing or that we think we should have let go of, and change them from things that feel like they're obstacles to our freedom to the very vehicles for our understanding. They can transform in that moment. We can see, oh, this is going to take me to understanding and freedom. And we can find ease and freedom right in the middle of an experience. Like for me, it was suddenly it released and there was ease right in the middle of this difficult situation. And so through processes like this, life that life gives us, that our minds and hearts give us in meditation, we really cultivate this quality of patience, which is absolutely essential on this path, in this practice. So maybe that's what this retreat is about. Is that okay? Is that okay? If that's what this retreat is about, it's just about developing patience? Because maybe that's what it is. Maybe we're not going to get into that beautiful state of absorption we're after, or, you know, have greed, hatred, and delusion just fall away, never to arise again. May it be so, but it might take another retreat. So we learn, we can develop patience, and through this practice of developing patience, we also learn a lot about forgiveness, which is another essential essential consideration. Does that word forgiveness, I want to make sure everyone knows what that means, because I'll probably say that word quite a few times in the rest of this talk. What's the Finnish word for forgiveness? Is there?
Anteeksi, anto.
Is that more than one word?
It's one word.
Really? Yeah. This Finnish is great.
Two put together.
Mm-hmm. I just love Finnish. It's like you can get some, what's like, how long is the biggest word?
Oh, it's true.
Really big. It's very cool. I love to hear people speaking it. So the Buddha taught that it's this energy of clinging, of grasping, of holding on in the mind and heart that is the root cause of so much suffering in our lives. And this shows up in all kinds of ways. And one of the ways that it can show up is clinging to memories of past hurts and the resentment and grudges that we might carry, or the guilt and shame that we may feel when it's something that we have done, things that have happened to us, things that we have done. And this is that energy of holding on in this particular way, and this is where this quality of being able to forgive is really an important consideration for us. And some of you have reported, and I know for myself, often in periods of meditation on a retreat, there will be memories that come up that are really difficult. Either memories of things we did, often it's that. Sometimes memories of things we didn't know they were in there. That can open up in meditation. We'll have a memory that of something that we had either repressed or completely forgotten, and it'll show up. And some of them, sometimes it's really hard. I remember one example. I have many examples of this, but one in particular, when I was very first starting to do longer retreat periods, and I remembered times of it when I was a child of really horrible things I did to insects as a child. Little boys, I think, maybe are particularly bad. But these memories of things that were cruel and horrible came into my mind, and I just felt this so much pain and remorse for having done these things. And, you know, it was really, really hard to be with. Sometimes these things may be things that we did, as I said. It can be things that happened to us. And they can bring back the feeling and the emotion, even though it happened years and years ago. It can come back and be so strong right in the moment. It can feel like it just happened. You ever have that experience where a memory, and then it'll feel like it'll be just as fresh as though it had happened earlier in the same day, almost? And it can just really get very intense. I remember one time I was, there's a way of doing metta practice that I kind of touched on the other day, where you think of a person and offer them kindness with using words. And in that way of practicing, you start where it's really easy, which is where I stayed, and then you go where it's, you know, a little harder and a little harder and a little harder, and eventually you get to where it's someone who's really difficult, a really difficult relationship. And I was doing a long period of metta practice for several weeks, and at a certain point the teacher who was guiding me through this had me go through these different categories, and so I came to this difficult relationship. Sometimes in the books, in the texts, it's called the enemy, developing kind thoughts for your enemy. And I couldn't think of anyone right away, and then this person and situation came to my mind that had happened years ago, and it wasn't somebody I ever saw. But when I thought of it, it was a time when I felt like I had been misunderstood and harmed and judged. And it was just like, it felt so fresh, and I felt this anger. And, you know, I noticed my metta phrase was, "May you be happy, you stupid idiot." Which that's not a real good metta phrase. So I had to kind of, you know, I was trying, so I had to go back where, you know, back to a neutral person or a friend and kind of remind myself what metta was. And I kept at it, but I was amazed how strong that was. And actually, working through it actually shifted the relationship. It didn't shift the relationship, it shifted how I felt through just keeping at it. But I had to do it a little bit. I had to, like, say, "Maybe happy? No." And then, you know, try again. It was hard. But it was interesting. What one of the things was how present that feeling was. Really surprised me in that time. So this quality of forgiveness, of forgiving, it points to the possibility that we can let go of this grasping to these old hurts and grudges and the suffering from anger and resentment or guilt when it's turned against ourselves. Because it can... we can keep us bound to cycles of suffering, and maybe we've seen this in our lives or know people where they're just caught in this cycle of resentment or guilt and suffering, and it can go on for years and years, and there's never any release in that. And so we forget that there's actually, we have a choice. We sometimes think we don't have any choice, but we actually do have some choice here if we work at this in a skillful way and with patience. We can, instead of holding on to painful memories and events in a way that harms us or influence or impacts our relationships, we can start to let them go and remove the burden of suffering, or at least reduce it quite a bit. And so engaging with or looking at this quality of forgiveness is really essential sometimes. So there's a few things that are really kind of critical when approaching this idea of forgiveness. First of all, we have to acknowledge that things happen, that there's suffering in our own lives, in the world, that sometimes this happens because of something we do to cause it, sometimes something that others do to us, and sometimes it seems to happen just because it's the nature of things. And it's not the truth, the whole truth. You know, there's joy and beauty and everything else, but this is an aspect of life, and we have to acknowledge that this is true, this is part of life, and that sometimes things happen that either we do or others do that cause pain, and that's a kind of critical place to start, you know, the suffering relationship to past injuries that may have happened to us, ways that we feel like we were harmed by someone, by something someone did. There's a way that those memories are often stored in the brain or in the mind, in the heart, that I think it easily triggers certain kinds of responses, alarms, you could say. There's a way that it's kind of it's related to self-care and self-preservation, that these things can get easily triggered again when certain circumstances happen. And when we have situations of real trauma and we have post-traumatic stress responses where something has happened and then something that will trigger that, the memory and the trauma will be right there again in very extreme cases. But we all have lesser ways that this shows up in our lives where these things get triggered sometimes. And so with this practice of forgiveness, there's the possibility that we can start to remove the burden, to actually allow the past to become the past and to be able to live in the present with some greater balance and stability and a sense of, you could say, a personal empowerment, maybe something like that. Because otherwise we can get stuck in cycles that get so locked into our system that they feel like they're that there's no freedom there, that we can't escape from it, and we can't move towards freedom, towards peace. In approaching the idea of practicing forgiveness, for example, towards someone who may have harmed you, the timing is critical, because sometimes it's not the right time. It may be too soon to even think about it. You know, we can't rush into this because we're supposed to do it, or because it's the right thing to do, or everyone says you should forgive or something. You know, sometimes what we really need to do is take care of ourselves and find strength and safety. Maybe we're not safe enough to do it because it's hard. And if we don't feel like we're in a strong and safe and secure place, we shouldn't. It may be the wrong time. And what we need to focus on is caring for ourselves first. And then sometime, maybe it will be the right time. So the timing is really critical, because we can't do it if we feel, especially if it's a situation where we feel actually in danger or not safe. We have to not go there. I was reminded when I was thinking about this subject and of a story that I read about some years ago, and then I recently was reminded of it. There was this story sets a high bar, a high aspiration for the points to a very kind of an incredible level of forgiveness. And this is a story about a woman who lived in the United States in a city in the middle part of the country. And this happened in 1993. And this woman, Mary Johnson, she had her only son. He was a teenager. And he was killed in a fight it was a gang situation, and he was killed. And there was a police investigation, and they eventually found a 16-year-old boy who confessed to having done the killing. It was a shooting. And there were all these hearings and appeals, the investigation. By the time it came to a trial, he was 18, and so he was put on trial as an adult in the U.S. judicial system. 18, you're considered to be an adult. He was convicted of second-degree murder, and he was given 25 years in prison at the age of 18. And the woman whose son was killed, she said, this is a quotation from her, she said, "I wanted him locked up, put in a cage, because I thought he was an animal and that's where he deserved to be." So that's how she said she was feeling at that time. But she was very active in her church. She was a very religious woman, and she, forgiveness was part of what they looked at in her church. And she worked on this for 10 years, trying to find ways to forgive, to find some forgiveness, and with her own work and work with the support of other people, she felt like she'd come to some place of forgiveness. And meanwhile, this young man, he's you know, he's in prison, growing up in prison, basically, and he's doing his own work with what he had done. And she decided, this is 10 years after he went to jail, so in 2005 she decided she had to find out if this, she felt that this forgiveness had happened. She wanted to see if it was real, so she tried she wanted to visit him, and he wouldn't see her at first, but over the course of a year he finally agreed to let her visit. And she went to see him, and they talked, and he admitted that he had done this, and that he'd killed her son. And she said, because apparently during the court thing, she had said, "I forgive you," but she said, "I told you that in court, but today, I from the bottom of my heart, I want you to know that I truly do forgive you." The other man, his name was O'Shea Israel, he said it was a very powerful meeting, and he said he felt compelled he wanted to give her a hug, and she agreed, but something in that moment, it was as though she fainted in a way. She had this kind of collapse, and he had to hold her up, and she said, "I remember falling, and he had to hold me up, and he held me up until I felt this thing leave me. I felt this energy leave me, and I instantly knew that all the hatred and the bitterness and that junk I had inside me for the last 12 years was gone. It was over with. It was done. In that instant, it was gone." And they started meeting. She started visiting him on a regular basis, and they became almost like mother and son, their relationship. And he finally got out of prison 7 years later. And she introduced him to the person who owned the building, apartment building, and he got an apartment next door to her, and lived next to her as though he were her own son. She said, "I treat you like I would treat my own son. My natural son is no longer here. I didn't see him graduate from college, but maybe I'll see you do that, because you're going to college now, and I'll have the opportunity to see that. And I never saw my son have a family, get married and have a family, but maybe one day I'll see you do that." And she said, "Unforgiveness, not forgiving, is like a cancer that will eat you from the inside out." She said, "It's not about that other person. Me forgiving him does not diminish what he's done. He murdered my son, but the forgiveness is for me." And this is really important, is that we're taking care of ourselves through this. It's an internal process, and it points to the fact that ultimately we're responsible for our own freedom, our own salvation, you could say. There's responsibility. You know, we forget that we have that how we feel, how we are inside, it's really in great part up to us. When we let the past dictate who we are in the present, we're giving it a power over us. We lose our own power through that. And it's really important, as she was saying, that forgiving someone does not remove their responsibility. You know, like she said, he did that. This isn't for him, this is for me. You know, we have to take responsibility. We all beings, we have to take responsibility for things we've done. This young man, he said, "I haven't totally forgiven myself yet. I'm learning to do that. I'm learning to forgive myself. I'm still growing towards trying to forgive myself." So a real process there. And so this points to another thing that's, I think, really useful is we have to be sure that we're not, if we ask someone to forgive us, we have to be careful that we're not putting the burden on them or asking them to remove our responsibility for something we've done, for actions we may have done. Maybe what we need to do is apologize, try to make amends, and ask for forgiveness, but we can't necessarily expect it to be given to us. They may not be able to, they may not be ready. And something that's really critical in this is we have to remember that we're not forgiving actions. Some actions are not okay, are never okay, cannot be forgiven. Some things are not forgivable. What we can do is maybe forgive a person who did them. And to me, the doorway into this is the doorway of compassion. You know, if we understand, as Marie said the other night, this teaching that mind is the forerunner of all things. The mind precedes all actions. All actions are born in the mind. And if the mind is under the influence of confusion and hatred, if there's suffering in the mind, if greed is there along with confusion, then actions that follow from that will have a certain quality. They'll go in a certain way. When someone acts out of confusion and suffering and pain, often harm happens. And in some people, the level of confusion and suffering is beyond anything we've ever even imagined. So we can start to forgive that suffering being, but we're not forgiving what they did. What they did is maybe not forgivable. So that's an important distinction, but we may start to be able to understand, because we can look in our own heart and see the same process. We see when these energies are there and the actions that lead to them. And so that's also the way, compassion, the doorway to forgiving ourselves for things we may have done. And it might not mean fixing the relationship. You know, in this story I told you about this practicing metta for this person that had harmed me, it's clear to me that I'm not going to have anything to do with this person. That's a clear boundary. But the resentment is gone. I can wish them well, but I'm not going to go, I don't have to go find them and give them a big hug. And that's not going to happen. It doesn't have to happen. So that kind of mending some relationships, that may not be part of it. There's a famous comedian, actress in the United States. I think she's still alive. She would be quite old now. She was very big in the 70s and 80s, named Lily Tomlin. And this quotation is said that she said this. She was very funny, but it's funny and poignant. She said, "Forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past." I don't know if that translates well. Giving up all hope of a better past. So we can give up hope of having a better past, right? We can't change that. But we can also release the weight of having to haul it around with us everywhere. So it doesn't mean that we're forgetting it, but we're letting go of the suffering that may be associated with things that happened in the past. And it's really important to remember, it's like what that young man said. He said, I'm still learning, I'm still working on forgiving myself. And it was a process. Or this woman in this story, it was 10 years of trying to approach this possibility. So we have to remember that it's a process, and it may be slow. And we can't expect it to just happen like that because we think it's a good thing to do. And so I'd like to look at it as with this image of planting seeds. You know, we're planting the seeds with the intention. And a seed, one seed can be a powerful thing. You know, a seed that falls in a crack of a huge boulder, a huge rock, it can sprout and the roots can crack that rock into two. So the potential power of these seeds we plant in all the different ways we do, the potential power is really huge, power of our intentions. So I'll stop at this point, and we can have a couple of minutes of quiet.